action. Next week, if you look at the course outline, you'll see there will be a summary, as it's called. And what I'm going to do in this summary is basically, since that will be the class just before you go on the Easter break, flag some of the issues that will be arising on the exam. It will not be the exam preparation class, but it will already give you some indication. So in case you want to do some more reading over the vacation, right, you'll begin to do that. And then at some point in the third term, I haven't decided what week, depends when I'm around, but at this class time, one of the weeks, there will be a formal exam session where I will basically give you a sense of the different kinds of things that will be on the exam. And for those of you, some of you who have had classes in the second year, half of you are in the third year, there are two separate exam papers. So whichever one is examined first, you will not have an advantage. I mean, the second ones won't have an advantage, okay. So that's, but I will start to summarize what the course is about with an eye to the exam next week. What I want to do this week is to kind of broaden, we've been talking about postmodernism, and in a way I want to kind of wrap this up in a more philosophical vein and talk about issues relating, I mean, these are words that you've run across so much in sociology, you know, relativism, constructivism, and then multiculturalism and feminism, and we've got whole courses devoted to these things, and the issue is, what do they have to do with each other? Why are they associated with each other? Okay? The way to begin this is, let's look at relativism. Okay? I take it all of you have run across relativism in your coursework in sociology at some point. And sometimes people even say that sociologists are by definition relativists. Okay? Now, relativism as an idea really gets off the ground in the late 19th century, well actually it's a 19th century idea generally speaking, and it's the view that truth, value, whatever normative idea you're talking about is relative to a particular culture or society. Right? So in other words, what relativism does in the first instance is to deny universalism. Right? The idea that there's one truth, one set of values. Okay? Now you can already see this is one reason why science and relativism are often seen as opposed to each other. Right? Because one of the things about science that I've been pointing out is that science does aim for a certain universal sense of truth and validity. Right? That everything can be understood scientifically. Now relativism denies this kind of viewpoint. I mean, one way you can think about relativism is in terms of the old saying, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, right? So in every culture, there is their own norms, and what is right and wrong has just to do with the culture you happen to be in. Okay? Now let's look at some of the presuppositions of relativism here for a moment. It's very hard to talk about relativism unless there is a sense in which the culture or society we're talking about is bounded, right? Relative to what? Right? So there has to be a what that's clearly defined. Right? That's a very important point, okay, because postmodernism, in a way, one of the ways in which postmodernism gets characterized very often is in terms of a position that breaks boundaries, that denies sharp distinctions. But see, relativism presupposes sharp distinctions, specifically between cultures, between societies. Right? What works in one society doesn't work in the other. They're two different things. Relativism recognizes that difference. Whereas the tendency in postmodernism is to blur the difference, or to deny the difference. Jacques Derrida, you know, the French deconstructionist. Have you run across, I hope you've run across him, I'm never sure what people run across, of course, so just do a little name check here. You've run across him? Derrida? Okay. He's the great master of deconstruction. He talks about putting binary oppositions, that is to say sharp distinctions between things, under erasure. right? So you draw an X over the binary opposition. And you see, relativism actually accepts boundaries and accepts these binary oppositions. Okay? Now, one of the first people who gets associated with relativism in the 19th century is German philosopher Herder. I don't know if you've run across him. He's usually seen as kind of romantic philosopher. He's the person who introduces this word, Kultur, which is the German word for culture. And the word culture, in the sense that we use it in English, where culture means not only the sort of the customs and mores of a society, but it also implies some kind of normative idea, right? There's a right way of behaving in the society, right? So your culture, right, is a kind of normative implication of that word, right? It's not just a descriptive word, but there's a normative character to it. This all comes from Herder, right? Because in that German Kultur, right? So the way of being that is appropriate to a particular place. Now, the word Kultur actually originates as a kind of shortened version of agriculture. Okay? So, what Herder was the person, you know, in the German sort of philosophical tradition, especially on the political side, there's a lot of discussion, which of course culminates in the Nazi period, of blood and soil. Okay? And culture is associated with that, right? Blood being, right, the race, the genetic makeup, the kind of people who are tied to a kind of place. Now, you've got to remember, when this idea is being floated in the early 19th century, we don't have Darwin yet. We don't have such a sharp distinction between genetics and the environment, right? There is this general idea still floating around that in some sense, the way we are in our environments, the way the environment shapes us, somehow gets into our germplasm, into our genes, right? And kind of, you know, so there's a sense in which our genes are carrying a kind of collective memory of the history of the people from whom we descend, right? You've probably run across this idea, right? Well, that's a blood and soil idea, very much associated with Herder and the original sense of Kultur, okay? And so what you start to get in the 19th century is you get a lot of discussions. This is before sociology gets off the ground as a formal academic discipline. You get a lot of discussion of things like national types, right? French culture, English culture, German culture, right? That whole way of speaking, where there seem to be like differences in worldviews between these people, which have to do with the fact they've inhabited these lands and interbreeded with each other for all of this time, right? You know, that's the nation part of the idea of the nation state. When we talk about nation state, the state part has to do with the fact that you have a kind of unified political system. But what is it bounding? Well, it's bounding a nation, and a nation is a group of people who are united by blood and soil. And hence, you've got the idea of the nation-state as having geographic boundaries, right, which are, as it were, historically determined. This is why you have all these wars and treaties and things, people claiming that this is ancestrally their land or that land, right? I mean, this is what the 19th century is largely about. Right, and we still, you know, and with the, you know, in a sense, the kinds of wars that you see in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians is this kind of extension of this kind of European way of looking at things that comes about with the idea of Kultur. Right, there's homeland, right? And that's where the notion of culture originally comes from, okay? It comes from that kind of way of thinking. So now this word, English, is one of the last of the major languages to actually pick up a variant of this word. So we have the word culture now, and it means pretty much like this, right? We talk about cultured people and British culture and all that kind of stuff. And the person responsible for that is Matthew Arnold. Have you run across Matthew Arnold? Oh, very important guy. One of the great Victorian essayists, okay? He was the headmaster at Rugby. So he's writing in the third quarter of the 19th century. He's coined a lot of words that we actually associate with our discourse of culture in this country. So, for example, Philistine, you know what that is, right? Philistine, right? Someone who's uncultured, uncouth, right? That comes from Matthew Arnold. It comes from a very famous essay of his called Culture and Anarchy. Culture and Anarchy. And Arnold is one of the people who makes a big pitch that the point of education is the instilling of culture. Now, see, this was already there in Germany. The Germans already had this. Humboldt was talking about it with the universities in the early 19th century. Matthew Arnold's writing in the 1860s, and he's basically making this kind of German point in the context of England, where at the time, right, we're talking about, you know, if you think about that period, think about Darwin's writing at that time, right, this is a period of kind of high capitalism, laissez-faire, people very interested in money, right, but what about, you know, art? What about literature, the humanities? Right, all that seemed to be kind of disappearing from view. I mean, some people accused Arnold of trying to just sort of salvage a kind of aristocratic culture that was fading in light of the developments of capitalism. Okay, but it was in that context the idea of culture comes in, right? And you start to get this rebirth in the idea that, you know, in order to be British, right, it's Shakespeare and Milton, right, and cricket, and, you know, these citizenship exams that, you know, that they're going to be popping up, right? This all, the Matthew Arnold is responsible for this, right? And again, right, the idea of Britishness presupposes that there's a clear way of distinguishing this, right? That you score 95 on the Britishness test, there are definite answers to questions about being British. Right? You need to know cricket, the rules of cricket. That's British. Okay? If you don't know, not British. Okay? Now, I'm bringing this up because, again, this is an example of how relativism works, where there's a strong sense of boundary, what's in and what's out. Okay? And, of course, what postmodernism does is postmodernism blurs or erases those boundaries. So one of the things that you see characteristic about postmodernism when it confronts something like the humanities and confronts something like Britishness is to say there are multiple Britishnesses. Right? You know? And even if we're reading Shakespeare, there are 100 billion ways of doing that. Okay? And so the whole idea of there being clear cultural identity, which is very essential to the traditional idea of relativism, gets blown apart by postmodernism. Okay? So that's a, you know, quite important aspect of the history. If you're interested in this kind of issue generally about this whole idea of culture, and the idea of British culture, and how does that get constructed from the period of Matthew Arnold to now, I would suggest you just look at the collected works of Raymond Williams. Are you familiar with that? Does that name mean anything to anyone anymore? He's dead. Usually when people die, they disappear, and no one hears about him anymore. But Raymond Williams, does that name mean anything to anyone? Literary critic, okay, he died, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago now. He was an incredibly big deal when I was a student at Cambridge. He was a professor of literature. You just look up his name. Anything by him is very interesting to read. He's got a very interesting book called Keywords, where he actually does kind of the histories of these key conceptual words, like culture and so forth, and shows you how they're done. And he's a Marxist, actually, so he has a kind of very critical line on all this. But he's the guy I would go to kind of get this sense of how the idea of culture played itself out in the history of Britain. Now, relativism, of course, widened its concern with anthropology. And so very often when people want to illustrate relativism, they talk about the native tribes, right? And all the strange and wacky ways in which they operate, right? They believe in strange entities, they believe they've descended from birds or something, right? They have all these crazy views, but nevertheless, their societies are functional, right? You know, and then the question is, how could that be? Well, answer is, these crazy beliefs they have are true for them. They're not true for us, but they're true for them. Okay, so they get this kind of anthropological kind of twist, which is typically the way in which relativism is presented by philosophers when they kind of argue about relativism. That's usually what they have in mind. They have that kind of sense of relativism where there are these exotic peoples who have these practices that are radically different from our own, but they still are surviving. Okay? And then the question gets asked in that context, are there any limits to relativism? In other words, do we just allow anything? So like, okay, I run across a society. The society eats its newborn, or every other newborn. Couldn't eat them all, otherwise they'd disappear. But they eat every other newborn. They make it into a delicacy. Okay? That's part of the norm. They got great schools of cuisine and so forth devoted to these things. Okay? And it's a kind of centerpiece of their culture. Any problems? They still survive. They're flourishing. They've got this very peculiar eating habit. But is there a problem? Okay? And this is the kind of question that gets asked about relativism. okay? And of course, one wants to get very super serious about this, right? One talks about the Nazis, right? Because then one says, well, look, you know, Hitler's elected into power democratically. People seem to be going along with him. I mean, he doesn't actually have to, you know, most people he doesn't have to be suppressing. You know, I mean, they seem to go along with the whole thing. It is the most scientifically advanced country in the world. What's wrong? We just happen to disagree with its politics, and of course, you know, there'll be a political struggle, but at the end of the day, you know, they're entitled to their beliefs, we're entitled to ours, and as long as they don't interfere with our ability to, you know, exercise our beliefs, it's cool, right? So as long as Germany doesn't want to take over the world, they can practice Nazism within their own borders, right? And so the only problem with Hitler is when he gets imperial, right? When he tries to take over the world. But prior to that point, if the German people are electing him, and what the German people are electing him for is exterminate Jews, and that's on the, you know, that's part of the party platform, and the people say, go to it, right? Because Jews make up whatever, 5% of the population. You know, the other 95% say, hey, no problem. Okay? Is there an issue here? Right? And people who are strict relativists, right, can't really, you know, get away from that. Right? In the sense of which, if you're a strict relativist, you're sort of stuck with that point. Right? Of course the argument then gets made, well, is the real world real, you know, is it, you know, was that really the situation, right? Because, you know, was it the case that in fact everybody endorsed all these values that Hitler stood for, et cetera, et cetera. You see, then people start arguing about the empirical side of it, about the facts of it. But if the people do agree to this, why not? Okay? Now, when you start to say things like, it violates human rights, it violates our sense of decency, you're universalizing. Right? And the question becomes, you know, in politics in particular, if you ever study international relations, there is this theory called realism, political realism, which basically operates on the assumption that there are no universal values per se. There are just these struggling nations. Each of them have their own values. They want to kind of pursue their own interests in the world, and that's kind of why they operate. And that the whole point of politics is to maintain a balance of power. Right? In other words, you pass no judgment on the legitimacy of the particular states. They all have their own interests to pursue. They might be radically different from each other. Right? But then what you aim for in politics is just a balance. That's to say, you make sure that one party doesn't dominate everybody, but everybody can go and pursue their ends, you know, as much as they want, regardless of what those ends are. So, for example, as you know, Western countries are increasingly concerned about human rights violations in China. Okay? Do they have a right to do that? Is it their business to do that? Okay? And, you know, and this is a very good test case for relativism, right? Because human rights violations are happening exclusively, entirely within the borders of China. Right, it's not like when the Chinese travel to Britain, they're, you know, oppressing British people when they come here, right? No, they act like we do when they come here. But when they're back home, right, they're suppressing people. Perfect relativists. Okay, is there a problem? Now, we seem to think there's a problem. But who are we to impose these values, you see? And this question comes up over and over again. This used to be the kind of argument that would be made by South African government with regard to the West nosing around on apartheid. You know, West getting very kind of upset and high moral ground and all that, and the government of South Africa says, look, it's not like we're imposing apartheid around the world, we're just doing it within our own borders for good historical reasons. So who are you to come in and tell us how we should be organizing our society? Okay. And so this is the kind of issue that relativism always runs across. And one of the things that it really kind of highlights is how does a relativist understand the idea of change? Moral change, right? Because societies do change. Right? They, you know, it's not like, I mean, one of the problems, this is something postmodernists are very good at pointing out, that one of the problems with an idea like culture or culture is it tends to be a kind of static notion, right? I mean, so when we think about Britishness or British culture, Right, you look at the kinds of things you get examined for. These are things that are plucked out from different periods in history, basically. Right, if you look at the origins of the thing, you know, so like Shakespeare's a 17th century figure, right, so is Milton, but then, you know, when is cricket invented? What, the 19th century? I don't know. But the point is that these are different things that come into play from different periods in history, and they're all kind of strung together and made into a kind of package. All right? I mean, even more so when we talk about, you know, when you look at the, you take these courses that teach you the classics of Western civilization, when in the sort of liberal arts tradition, my undergraduate training was very much of this kind, where what you're doing it's what they call in America the Plato to NATO course, okay? Now you think, what's going on there, right? I mean, because what you have is this kind of static notion of Western civilization, right, to which, you know, everybody from Plato to NATO are contributing to, and they are somehow all seen as talking about the same things, right? So the problem of justice, right? We could be reading Plato's Republic, or we could be reading the Charter of the Declaration of Human Rights in the United Nations. Okay, whatever, 2,500 years separate them. Okay, but nevertheless, they're talking about the same thing. It's as if they were, you know, both were in the room together. And this is kind of how you learn a lot of this liberal arts stuff, kind of in this very, very kind of de-historicized sort of way. And this is how you create this image that there is this solid thing called a culture that people are, generation after generation, carrying along and contributing to. But of course, cultures change, right? Things, societies change. But how does a relativist deal with that issue? Right? Because, you know, somebody might, you know, when one looks at, say, okay, China doesn't have a strong historical tradition of human rights. True. Well, can it change? Maybe it can learn a new trick. Maybe it can make human rights part of its own culture and tradition. Why not? Is there something preventing that from happening? You see? And you know, from a relativist standpoint, right, what is a relativist going to say? Relativist is going to somehow have to say, well, if there is going to be this change, it has to, in some sense, be internally driven. Right? It has to come from within the culture. Right? It cannot be imposed from the outside. But, of course, the world isn't quite so neat, right? Obviously, the people in the inside, following things on the internet, studying in Western countries, whatever, right, they pick up all these ideas of, you know, human rights and so forth. And so even though they are Chinese, they've kind of assimilated a lot of Western stuff, which they then translate into the Chinese cultural context. Now, you see, if you think about this as a social process that might go on for several generations, you begin to start to think that, you know, maybe there's something to this postmodern stuff after all, in the sense that maybe the boundaries aren't so clear, right? That there's maybe more transit, as it were, between what's going on inside and outside of China than the whole idea of Chinese culture would suggest. You see, and the more you can, you know, sort of identify and document this kind of traffic, this kind of intellectual cultural trade from between places, the less relativism looks so strong. It doesn't look so strong because it looks like, well, the boundaries are kind of porous. Things are moving back and forth. Okay? You know, so for example, take a look at the relationship between this country and the United States. Is there a clear difference? You know, where's the line drawn? Exactly. You know, I mean, British culture, American culture, turn on your TV, you know. Listen to the way even announcers speak these days. Lots of North American accents around, okay. Much more, by the way, much more so than when I was a student here 25 years ago. This is something that's happened, you know, in your lifetime, this whole transformation. So now, the whole business of, you know, trying to demarcate, and so you think about, for example, the way in which American usage gets into British usage. So even at the way in which we would normally distinguish culture in terms of language and idiom, even that's kind of blurring and fading. Okay. I have to say, every time somebody tries to bring up the distinction between American and British culture to me, as usually older people, you know, it always sounds forced. It never sounds right. It always seems like, well, no, actually the distinction isn't that strong. Okay. And again, that goes against relativism. Right? And this is where postmodernism comes from. Postmodernism comes from this kind of breaking down of boundaries, this kind of blurring that you see from the greater transit between people. Okay. Now, now there's this other word, constructivism. And sometimes people think of constructivism and relativism as being the same thing. I don't. I don't think they're the same thing. I mean, though you could be both, I suppose, but they're different. They're talking about different things. When someone's a constructivist, what they're drawing attention to, as the word suggests, is the constructed quality of things. That is to say that these things aren't natural. So we can, let's take the idea of culture, for example. Okay? Now, if you read somebody like Herder in the early 19th century, and maybe even someone like Matthew Arnold later on in that century, you can easily get the impression that these guys ultimately have a kind of what you might call biological essentialism, right? There's a sense in which the people of Britain, the people of Germany, right, understood in a kind of, you know, racial, quasi-racial way, right, have this culture in them, which they convey, okay? That's not constructivist. That's the opposite. That's kind of what they call essentialist, right? That there's some kind of natural, essential thing, right? And as it were, when we give you a course on British culture, right, what we're doing is we're acquainting you with something that's already inside of you as British people, right? You've got that British essence in you, and you now need an opportunity to have it manifested. And, you know, somebody like Matthew Arnold, for example, thought that with all the great emphasis on money during the capitalist period in the 19th century, that in a sense people were suppressing their culture. Okay, so it's not that people have to learn culture in the sense of learning something that is completely alien to you, but rather reacquainting yourself with something that's already inside of you. Right? And this idea that that's what the point of culture is and cultivation, this idea actually goes back to Plato. If you read Plato's dialogue, the Meno, okay, it's basically a dialogue about the nature of education. And Plato is, see, the sophists, remember Plato's great enemies, the sophists, those are the guys who, you know, teach you how to speak well and argue your case in the public forum. The sophists have this very instrumental view about what education is, right? It's all training to get things done. Means to an end, right? And basically what I'm giving you is I'm selling you tools. I'm selling you techniques. I'm selling you things you didn't have before. That's why you need to buy my stuff. Now Plato does not see it this way. Plato says, actually when you know, education means that I elicit from you some deep knowledge that you have, but you haven't had an opportunity to manifest or express yet. And so the famous case in the Meno is of the slave boy from whom Socrates is Plato's mouthpiece, is able to elicit a geometric proof from. Ignorant slave boy, but Socrates, by probing questions, right, the so-called Socratic questioning, right, is able to get the schoolboy to kind of, the slave boy, to sort of reason through the steps of a geometric proof without ever having studied geometry before. Okay? And this is an argument, Plato says, for the fact that all that knowledge is already there, and what you just need is the opportunity for it to be elicited. Okay? Now that's essentialism, right? That's a kind of essentialist view of knowledge. It's already there, and education just picks it out. Constructivism is the opposite view. Constructivism is kind of what the sophists were about. Namely, you know, you don't have it until I give it to you. Right? This knowledge has got to be constructed for you. And then you have to construct it for yourself. Okay? So, you know, if culture, what is culture? Culture is me telling you to read some books, you reading them, and you remembering them. End of story. Right? It is a social process. It is not eliciting essences or deep knowledge or anything. It is the transmission of a well-defined entity, right, from me to you. And in fact, if there's some difficulty in the transmission, we may have to co-construct stuff. So I have to explain to you what Shakespeare means, okay? And then you understand what Shakespeare means. And how do I know you understand? Because you can give me the right answer on the exam. Okay, this is a very constructivist way of looking at these matters. Okay? So there's no deep essence or anything. There is just these kinds of social performances that go back and forth and which together manufacture a kind of knowledge. Okay? And postmodernists are generally constructivists. That's why they're very skeptical of an idea that there is something deep like British culture. No, British culture is constructive. What's British culture? It's whatever Gordon Brown decides on that exam you have to take to be a citizen. That's British culture. Okay? And so, of course, if you start thinking of things this way, and certainly the sophist thought of things this way, right, is, okay, if knowledge is just a construction, social construction, then I better be in the room when it happens. Right? In other words, you know, those who have the power to construct end up constructing the knowledge. Okay? And so the idea of power aspect of knowledge comes into play. It's not like there's some deep, essential form of knowledge already there, regardless of whether anyone has access to it. Okay? But rather, knowledge is what's constructed, and so therefore it becomes very important that you be one of the constructors. Okay? So constructivist approaches to education, for example, which, you know, often there's this whole critical pedagogy. I don't know if you've run into that, those of you who ever do any education research, you know. Critical pedagogy is this idea of empowering students, right? One of the things that this view often involves is that students have to take responsibility for constructing the knowledge in the classroom. And they've got all kinds of ways of doing this, right? But whatever it is, you know, however it happens, it's not just me imposing stuff on you. So you change the power relations of how the construction takes place so that the students are themselves co-constructing the knowledge. Okay? Because otherwise then it just becomes a relation of dominance from me to you. Okay, so the idea of constructivism takes very seriously the fact that knowledge is a social process and that it does matter who's constructing. Right? Because that's where the power of knowledge lies, is in the ability to construct. Okay. Now, what this means, of course, is you can construct boundaries between different cultures, or you can deconstruct boundaries between different cultures, right? So on the question that relativism sees as very vital, namely the idea that there has to be these separate cultures or societies, you know, relative to which there are forms of knowledge, right? Constructivism's view is, well, it just depends what you construct. You can construct two societies, or you can deconstruct the boundary and have one society. No problem, you can do it either way. So constructivism doesn't have a strong line on relativism. So in principle, for example, you could be a constructivist and a universalist. Right? You could say, well look, I want to construct a form of knowledge that applies to everyone. Okay? And then you can tell a kind of story about this. So for example, I mentioned a few weeks ago with regard to both the monotheistic religions and science, the role of proselytism, right? Proselytizing, the whole idea of my, the way in which evangelists and so forth, right? People actively recruiting people to the faith. That's proselytism, okay? And the monotheistic religions, especially Christianity and Islam, are very strong proselytizing religions. Most of the other religions are not. Science is very proselytizing too, especially if you watch somebody like Richard Dawkins, right? Namely, you know, if you don't believe in science, you're an idiot, right? You know, believe in science now. And all this business about making sure people learn science and all, that's proselytism too. Okay? And universalist forms of knowledge often have this kind of proselytizing going on. Why? Well, because people aren't born holding this knowledge. Right? You have to kind of give it to them somehow. They have to make it available to them somehow. And so you can imagine a certain kind of universalized constructivism through this process of proselytizing. Right? You know, Christianity started off with Jesus and 12 guys. Okay? And all of a sudden, they're just pushing the line. They're just moving from place to place, you know, converting people. Right? Spreading around the world. Right? And that's an example of trying to universalize, understanding it from a constructivist standpoint. Because what you're talking about are all these disciples, apostles, missionaries, whatever, spreading around, talking to people, forcing people occasionally, to get them to believe certain things. That's a constructivist explanation. Now, of course, if you talk to a Christian, they're not going to give you that account. They're not going to give you a constructivist account of how this happened. Because that looks a bit, you know, that looks like you're just forcing a religion down people's throats. Right? Constructivism would give you that kind of view about how religion spreads. Okay? But rather, they would say, no, I'm providing an opportunity for them to look into their souls, which I presume they already have, and to discover Jesus in it. Right? So you get kind of a quasi-essentialist kind of account from a religious person about what's going on in proselytizing. It's not like I'm forcing the religion on you, you know, or scaring you into it or something, right? But rather, I am enabling you to discover something about yourself. Okay, that's sort of essentialist gloss. So this process of how religion spreads, right, could be understood either way. Okay? And as sociologists, of course, we tend to have a preference to the constructivist line on everything. Right? So we tend to give a constructivist explanation to everything. Now, of course, what is the net effect of a constructivist explanation? Generally speaking, it is to demystify the thing you're explaining. Right? Because you think about the religion example I just gave, right? You know, the constructivist account says Christianity spreads around the world, right? By, you know, a lot of arm twisting and coercion and scaring people and persuading people too, of course, you know, and just laying it all out for them. So it's like a very big kind of push, concerted effort kind of thing. Which, you know, looks like a kind of political social movement. But from the standpoint of a Christian, what's going on is people are discovering Jesus. And, you know, Jesus has potential in your soul to be realized. And it sounds a lot better that way. Right? It sounds more real. Right? It sounds like there's, you know, that you're really getting to kind of understand yourself better and understand where you fit in the cosmos. Now, you could do the same thing, right, with regard to any kind of social phenomena, right? You can give a constructivist explanation, which will typically be demystified, or you can give, as it were, the explanation that people who engage in the practice normally give. And most people who engage in practices that they take seriously tend to be essentialist about them. Okay? You know, so you can contrast, for example, Marx's account of capitalism, you know, with what a captain of industry thinks is going on, right? I mean, in the 19th century especially, that was very striking. You get a very striking distinction there, right? So Marx, as you know, the Marx story, right, it's, you know, there is all this business about the pursuit of profit and all that, and he explains it in very systemic kinds of terms. Whereas if you actually talk to a successful capitalist, or even some member of the proletariat, both will tend to sort of think about this in much more individualistic terms, about qualities of themselves, right? So capitalist says, you know, well, the reason why I'm able to make all this money is by dint of hard work and effort and diligence, you know, and the Protestant ethic and all that kind of stuff, right? And if you talk to the proletariat, and this is the thing that made Marxism such a tough sell for people, right? The working class people often believe stuff like that too, right? In other words, they sort of say, well, you know, I guess I am kind of lazy and I just don't have it in me, and these guys, you know, who made these millions of pounds, man, they're just like, you know, they just work so hard, and then if I was as diligent as they, you know, and I read their autobiographies about what great men they were, and I hope that someday I might be able to emulate them in my own small, insignificant way, and perhaps open up a shop somewhere, you know, be petit bourgeois, you know, and this is very prevalent among working class people. You might be related to some of them. Who knows? I mean, this idea that the working class people, as well as the wealthy people, might have equally mystified views, essentialized views, basically believing that there's something about themselves that is on display when one talks about where they are in economic order. Right? This is connected to a very important concept Hegemony. Have you run across this in any of your courses? Hegemony, okay, is a very good term, comes from Antonio Gramsci. And this is kind of what we're talking about here. And it's one of the reasons, you might say it's the ultimate target of constructivism is something like hegemony, okay? So hegemony is basically a totalizing ideology. That's to say, everybody believes it, even if it's not to their benefit. Right? So the working class people who believe it's their fault that they're not richer are basically sharing the same ideology as the rich guys. Right? So they all believe kind of in a Protestant ethic, except that the working class people believe they're lazy, they're not trying hard. But they believe the ethic in fact works, and is what is responsible for whatever success the rich guys have. And of course the rich guys believe it works, and that they're living embodiment of it. Okay? So both sides share the same ideology. Even though one side clearly is disadvantaged by it. Okay, so you would kind of internalize a sort of sense of self-loathing. That's one of the consequences of hegemony for a lot of people. Okay? So that is the kind of sense of essentialism, right, that needs to be deconstructed, right, by something like Marxism. Okay. So that's how all those things relate to each other, constructivism and essentialism and relativism and universalism, all these isms. Now we've got multiculturalism. Okay? Now multiculturalism is a very funny idea. Okay? Because remember how I was saying earlier that relativism it's kind of ambiguous exactly how does relativism deal with the problem of change in a culture. Okay? Multiculturalism in a way embodies this problem because sometimes there are two ways of thinking about multiculturalism. One way is basically in a pretty static way. It's to say, look, there are loads of cultures out there and they all need to be maintained. You know, it's kind of like the butterfly collection approach to culture, right? Where you got all these different species of culture out there, and they all need to be respected and need to be preserved and conserved and so forth, and somehow recognized and represented in our, what, educational system, political system, whatever. That's one sense of multiculturalism, a very strong kind of view. It is a kind of relativistic view. Okay? The other kind of view of multiculturalism is much more dynamic, okay? And that also grants that there's a lot of diversity of cultures, but the diversity isn't fixed, right? So in other words, people are shifting allegiances, right? So what multiculturalism indicates in the second sense is the idea that culture is moving many different ways at once. Okay, I think the best way you can see this idea is in a way in which cultures get hybridized, right? A way in which you get elements of two or more different cultures coming together, like in music, art, right? I mean, style. I mean, that's kind of the most obvious ways of seeing it, of course. But even when when we try to put together a multicultural curriculum, and we try to have representatives from Africa and Asia and so forth. In the curriculum, right, it's quite natural once you see these texts juxtaposed to each other for people to want to mix and match them in some way in their own writing and so forth. So that whole presentation of multiculturalism as a package, right, so for example, as a course, where you have 10 authors from 6 different cultures, right, the response of people, it will be to somehow combine them in different ways, not to just treat them as separate entities. So the presentation of multiculturalism, even in its static form, tends to lead to hybrids and dynamic configurations. Okay, but you see, the tricky point here with multiculturalism comes with this idea of identity politics, and you've probably run across that. You know, so for example, this is a problem in the United States, very strongly associated with the black community, the African American community. Namely, to what extent should blacks, who historically were segregated from whites first through slavery and then actually under the law when they were free for 100 years, to what extent should they assimilate and hybridize and kind of blend in, as it were, with the dominant white culture. Okay, to what extent? Will that cause the blacks to lose their distinctive identity? Will that be selling away your heritage? Okay, so in the United States, and you may, you know, there are elements of this in this country as well, Afrocentrism, right? Afrocentrism, which is this idea that, you know, Africa has, you know, there's this essence of Africa, as it were, right? Which, you know, African Americans really have to kind of orient themselves toward, otherwise they become corrupt in the white man's world. Okay? And that's a whole very strong sense of identity politics. This is an issue that causes an enormous amount of conflict in the black community. And of course you've got versions of this with regard to in the Muslim community. You've got all sorts of, every culture has a version of this problem, okay? And it's not merely an internal problem, because it ends up spilling over to how the rest of the society regards people. Okay? And so this business of identity politics is kind of a very sore part of multiculturalism. The one other thing I want to say, and I'm going to pick up on this starting in the next class when we go into the summary, because there are questions on the exam concerning feminism, okay? And can't cover all of feminism in 5 minutes. Don't worry, I'm not going to cram it all in. Just initiate the discussion here. The first thing about feminism, as you know, women are most of the population. So it's in a way, it's a very curious kind of movement for that reason to begin with, right? Because it's quite common to think about feminism in the context of, you know, identity politics and multiculturalism is sort of part of that whole thing. Except that typically those other movements tend to be minority movements. Right? And there's issues of dominant culture that's dominant in sheer numbers very often, right? But women, of course, are the majority. Okay. Now this then raises a very interesting question about exactly what the point of feminism is. Okay? Is it, on the one hand, a kind of identity politics for women? Like the way Afrocentrism would be for blacks. Is it something like that? Or is it a kind of vehicle for a certain kind of universalism? Right? In a sense where, you know, in the way in which Marxism was. Right? Marxism Marxism was a movement that in a sense, its frame of reference was the working class. They are the majority of the people in the society. They are unrepresented. They are powerless. But they are the majority of people in the society. And once you emancipate them, right, then you are able to emancipate all of humanity. Because finally, the bulk of humanity will have been taken on board seriously. That's kind of what so Marxism is a kind of universalism that uses the working class as its leverage. Because there's so many of them. They're the majority of the people. Well, is feminism like that, you see? Does feminism have a logic similar to Marxism in that regard? Namely, women are the majority of people in the society. Right, and use women as a leverage for a true universalism. Now, I point this out because a lot of the concepts of feminism are in fact parasitic on Marxism. Right, that feminism to a large extent theoretically has been modeled on Marxism. Okay, the key issue here is this idea of standpoint. You've run across this in your feminism courses, right? Okay, so standpoint is an idea that comes from the Marxist tradition, all right? And it comes from Lukács, the proletarian standpoint. In his book, History and Class Consciousness, 1923, Lukács actually theorizes an aspect of Marx that Marx, in a way, kind of took for granted, but never really kind of said it very clearly. And that was the idea that as it were, Marxist theory and Marxist politics are done from a particular standpoint. Right? It's seeing the world from a particular standpoint. It's seeing the whole world, but from a particular standpoint. So the whole point about standpoint is it's not relativism. Right? Because relativism is, you know, just representing yourself and your group. Right? That's what relativism is about. But standpoint is the idea that you're seeing the whole world, but from a particular point of view. I hope you see the difference there, because that's very crucial with regard to how the logic of Marxism and feminism works, right? So you've got this group of people, the proletariat or women, who, because of their numbers and their position in society, have a kind of privileged standpoint. It's not privileged in the sense that they have the most money or the most political power as understood conventionally, but you might say epistemologically. That is to say, in terms of the knowledge that they have of things, they have the right kind of knowledge that is needed for a transformation of society. Now, in the case of the proletariat, the idea is, right, that these workers are the closest to the means of production. You know, if they're not on the job, nothing happens in capitalism. Okay, so that was the literal idea of the proletarian standpoint. Women, right, are in control of lots of things. Households, reproduction of society, right, there are all these other kinds of generalized social functions that women, as it were, are in a privileged position vis-a-vis, without which society cannot proceed. And so then the question becomes, if we are able to reconstruct society from that particular privileged standpoint, we would then have the basis for transforming society and making it more self-conscious and emancipatory and all the rest of it. That's the idea. All right? And so feminism picks this up from the Marxist tradition. All right. Now, we can't go any further on this point now, but of course the history of feminism since that time has moved in many different directions. And it's not at all clear that feminism today, or most of feminism, would actually characterize itself in this fashion. Okay, but that's how it began, right? As a kind of universalizing movement from a particular standpoint on analogy with the proletarian standpoint in Marxism. Okay? So I'll begin with this point next time and then move on to the summary of the course.
That kind of takes my mind to sin.